morning. This is Terry Wilson, Kilo Bravo 7 Sierra India. And in the studio with me, I have a gentleman by the name of Don Hilgartner, Whiskey Alpha 7 Tango Echo Mike, Joanne Rideout, station manager, Kilo Echo 7 Romeo Kilo Hotel, and running the controls is Kate Brister, Kilo Golf 7 Delta Papa Tango. Now, what are all these words? I know some of you know what I'm doing.
I love that kind of talk, Terry.
But to some of you, you may not know. I was using the phonetic spelling of our ham radio call signs. When you are trying to communicate over radio, sometimes with static and all sorts of language problems and that, it becomes very, very difficult to communicate. So what we do is we spell words using a phonetic alphabet. Now it's called the Ikkyo phonetic alphabet. Back in the days of when Don and I got started in the military in that, we used
Abel Baker Charlie Dog. It was the old World War II alphabet.
And as aviation started bringing countries together, it became necessary for pilots and crews who did not speak Abel Baker Charlie and that sort of thing to be able to communicate. So they came up with the Ikkyo phonetic alphabet. It has something to do with airplanes. I was on radio watch at midnight in the middle 1950s when that happened. And we went to Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo, Foxtrot.
You're not going to go through the whole alphabet, are you? No.
And I'll never forget in the Navy Times, which we got copies of up at the Coast Guard Land Station in ADAC, there was an old radio officer who wanted, Don and I, when we talked to each other on radio, he might say to me, "Did you get that?" And I would say, "Roger, I got that." And this old radio officer wanted to know, do we have to say, "Roger, I got that," or "Romeo, I got that," because that was the letter R. Mm-hmm. So that's the start of why I use those terms.
And those are, Terry, you might want to talk a little bit about that. We're all ham radio operators, and those are our legal call signs that we must say when we go on a ham radio. It allows us to use the ham radio frequencies,
Right.
And if you don't have that license, you're not allowed to go on those frequencies. So all of us were kind of in the emergency biz, so to speak, as a sideline of our radio work. And so that's the reason, at least probably why Kate and I have those licenses, is because of the emergency.
As a matter of fact, Don and I both have our license plates on our car, our ham call sign. This enables us, in an emergency, when we go
remember
through
your call sign. That would be me.
when we go through police lines and that, they recognize that we're there, and we're there perhaps on business.
And in fact, that's one of the advantages of the amateur radio plate, is that unlike a vanity plate, like My Fish or something like that, where you pay an extra fee every time you renew, our amateur plates, we pay the same fee as the regular plates.
Oh, really?
And that legislation dates back actually to the 1920s, when amateur radio operators were recognized as being a resource for public safety operations. And two-way radios and police cars and fire engines were unknown at that time. And so it was assumed that in an emergency, if a police officer saw an amateur radio license plate, he could have the amateur radio operator in that car contact the city station, which would then contact the police station and tell them what was going on. And it was recognized as a public service that amateur radio operators provided. And so we were exempted from having to pay vanity fees.
Wow, that's... Well, I think in our area, at least, of course, I'm in the radio realm, so I don't know how widely people are aware of this, but certainly KMUN's regular listeners and KTCB's regular listeners are aware of the fact that radio plays a big role in any kind of a serious emergency. And we all are, we want to harken back to 2007, because that was the big example when big storm hit here, knocked out the power, knocked out cell phone service, pretty much knocked out everything related to electricity for about a week.
Seattle and Portland didn't even know we were having a problem.
Mm-hmm. And so as people who were here at the radio station, I wasn't the manager then, but I was involved as a volunteer. This station became a hub for information because we had a generator. We could still go on the air. But where we got that information was from these two people here, especially Terry, who was working with the station as our engineer, who the interface between, that was when we started to understand the important role of ham radio people in an emergency, because ham radio operators are part of the county's emergency response plan, because, you know, we can talk about Facebook and Twitter and all the social media and all the cell phones and la-di-da-di-da, but when the electricity goes out and you can't get any of those things, it's the ham radio people who are going to be able to hold the system together and get the information out there. So that's a really important piece that I'm not sure that people quite get how, because these folks are doing this really kind of as a hobby for fun.
Most of them don't get paid.
Most of them get paid for it unless they're in some emergency services role with the county or state. So this is a hobby that is extremely vital in an emergency and is really pivotal and can be at times the only way to communicate.
So. Yeah, in fact, the motto of the Amateur Radio Emergency Services is when all else fails, amateur radio will still get through.
Yes.
And it is because we operate this as a hobby, and so the operators themselves tend to push the envelope of what is possible and what can be done. And so when other people are thinking about how they would, public safety agencies are limited by their budgets and the day-to-day operation on how much they can experiment. We, on the other hand, can push the envelope. So when other people are thinking about how can I communicate from my car, our folks are thinking about how can I communicate from my handheld. When they are talking about how can I send a text message or talk on my cell phone, amateur radio operators are talking about how can I put a video camera into a hat and then televise, as I do the Columbia River crossing to the Emergency Operations Center, what is happening in the middle of the bridge. And we had this happen during some of the earlier Columbia crossings that we were involved with.
Wow.
Okay, Don, who are hams? How did they get started?
Ham radio operators started in the very, very earliest days of radio. In fact, initially, radio waves were not licensed or controlled at all. Anybody could jump on. Well, because of all of the interference with Army, Navy, and especially ship communications, it was decided on an international basis that it had to be controlled. It had to be modified, and operators had to be licensed. Well, in addition to the commercial operators, many of whom were originally landline telegraphers, because voice communications was not done over radio in those days, most of the communications, almost all of it, was done by Morse code. And so as a result, landline telegraphers who had been on Western Union, the Army, and the Navy were pulled into commercial service. But there were people who were experimenting with radio, saying, how far can we reach with this medium? What else can we do with it? And Sir Hiram Maxim was a man who decided that these experimenters needed to get organized. If they were going to be heard by Congress in the United States, they needed to have an organization. So he formed the Amateur Radio Relay League, which then set up, for want of a better term, a union of non-commercial operators. And then when legislation was finally put forward controlling the radio waves, amateur operators were included in it on two conditions. One was that they would be experimental. They would always try to be pushing the edge of technology. And the second thing was they could not do what they were doing for profit. They could not make any money off it. They could not compete with the commercial companies. And that's where amateur radio started. Now, one of the number of questions that comes up is, why are they called hams? Well, there's a couple of stories on that. One is the radio waves originally were referred to by a German physicist named Heinrich Hertz. And so radio waves, before they were called radio waves, were called Hertzian waves. And so Hertzian amateurs became hams. The other one was probably a little bit more accurate. That's the one that we tell that gives us the glorious one. And the other one was that the professionals complained about the amateurs because the communication was in Morse code. One of the phrases that they used was that you were sending Morse code as if you have a ham on your fist. And the ham operators, much like the original Revolutionary War Minutemen, took this derogatory term, where the Minutemen took Yankee Doodle, which was a British derogatory term for Americans, took the ham terminology and said, yes, we are ham operators. We are not commercial. We are not professionals. And we are quite proud of it. And that's where the term ham radio came from.
Well, Don mentioned that about the improvements in technology. A lot of the changes in the way we communicate were brought about by hams. They experimented. Single sideband, which our fishing boats use farther out to sea, was invented by hams. Cable television was invented in Astoria by a gentleman by the name, I just forgot his name.
Ed Parsons, and there's a plaque dedicated to him up at the base of the Astoria Tower. As you enter that cement walk and you see the big map of Clatsop County of what you could see from the tower, to the right and down on the ground is a small brass plaque that says, cable transmission in the United States started right here. And
wow.
That was by Ed Parsons. Who,
and he was a ham.
And he was a ham radio operator. Of course, some
wow.
people, you know, there is various fights about where cable TV start. New York says they started it. Philadelphia says they started it. But the earliest involvement and improvements on it were all done here. And there was a very interesting book written by his son that's available in most of the Astoria bookstores called Ghost in the Arctic, which talks about how he then set up the Alaska communication system that's still in use to this day. And again, because he was a ham radio operator. Much of the technology, such as you folks on KMUN broadcast FM, it is frequency modulated. That was more or less an invention of a gentleman named Edwin Armstrong, who was an amateur operator on the East Coast that wanted to figure a way of how do we send a signal out of music without all of this rotten static that we have on amplitude modulation.
Hmm.
He invented FM. Much of the cell phone technology is based on technology that was done by amateur radio operators.
The transistor was invented by some engineers at Bell Labs, mm-hmm. who were hams.
And we continue to this day. A lot of people had a picture of the ham radio operator being an old man sitting in front of an old World War II tube radio, glowing in the dark with a Morse code key, sending Morse code. But as Terry just noted at the start of this program, 50% of the ham radio operators sitting in this room are women. And
woo-hoo.
We have a number of women who are in our program. And in fact, for those of you out there that are listening and have radio scanners capable of listening to the amateur radio frequency, every Sunday night at 8 p.m. is what we call our Who Net. And this is the women ham operators. No men are allowed on the net. It's a women net control, and women get on, and they talk about things that are of interest to women.
And when you and I got started as hams, there were not very many women.
No.
But it's really changed. And in our local area, the storm of 2007 really pushed that envelope.
Mm-hmm. In fact, that, you know, there were a lot of people became ham radio operators after that storm, and I was one of them. And so I just want to share a little bit about how I got my ham license, because mm-hmm. it really wasn't that difficult. You may think, I don't know anything about radio. Well, you know, I didn't either. So I went to kind of a crash course over a weekend, which is a course that's given locally every now and then. And I sat through this intensive course and took the test and got my license. And my reason for doing that was I wasn't the manager of KMUN then. I was a person who lived in a remote part of the county. And I looked around during that storm and saw that the trees were down, power lines were down, our cell phones didn't work, we had no electricity, we had no heat unless you had a wood stove. And I thought, if anything really serious had happened in my neighborhood, there would have been no way for any of us to get help. And I thought, if I were a ham radio operator, I could at least get on my ham radio and call for help and get a helicopter in there or get somebody to come in and, you know, chainsaw their way into our neighborhood and get some help. So that was my initial motivation. A lot of other people went and got ham radio licenses around that time as well. And since then, we have a number of people on our staff here who have become ham radio operators. We have a ham radio station here, And we have made our station available to the ham radio community during any kind of a difficulty, because we do have a generator here and at our tower to keep what we're doing working and keep the ham station on the air. So we have a pretty big commitment to ham radio here at KMUM, but I know there are a lot of people around the community who independently have gotten their ham radio licenses. And if this interests you for your own reasons, you could check with the ham radio clubs and find out when the next class is, because it really is very accessible. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to understand everything about the radio units. You just have to be willing to sit there and learn and absorb some information and pass a test, which was very accessible, I thought.
The youngest ham I ever met was in Seaside during CPAC, mm-hmm. and she was 5 years old.
Wow.
And she now, I think, is 11 or 12 or maybe even a teenager. That was a few years back. But however, she was from Eugene, Oregon, and she now holds the highest level of amateur radio operation, what's called amateur extra.
Wow.
She has all privileges.
All of the privileges to operate on any licensed amateur radio frequency in any mode, from Morse code through voice, through television, through any of the digital modes that are out there. Now, Terry mentioned CPAC, and that is a Seaside Pacific Amateur Radio Convention, which is going to happen this weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, in Seaside at the Convention Center. That will be bringing anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 amateur radio operators and their families to Seaside to get together, to learn more about ham radio, to find out what is the latest technology, to see all of the latest gee-whiz equipment that is out there, and also includes one of the largest swap and flea markets in the Pacific Northwest, where they will get rid of their old radios so they can buy new radios and get new equipment. And the CPAC this year is going to be very interesting, because I was just telling Joanne before we went on the air, in Portland area, they are predicting in the high to mid-90s, and so all of the weather people are telling everybody to go down to the coast. Well, we've already got 8,000 to 10,000 amateur radio operators and their families bringing in several thousand dollars spending this particular weekend down at the coast.
So the moral of the story is, if you're in Portland and you can hear us, get a reservation for your motel, because you're going to need one.
Or it's too late.
Yeah.
Joanne mentioned that we have a ham station here in at KMUN. And I remember when I made application for a license for the station, I got Dawn mentioned ARRL, the Amateur Radio Relay League. Because I am a member of that, I contacted them. And I was talking to a gentleman, and he found out who we were and what we did. And he says, "Oh, I love click and clack."
Uh-huh.
And so he got us a ham call sign. Our ham call sign here at the station is K7MUN.
That's very fun.
And part of our preparation for doing emergency service is every year on the last weekend of June, nationwide, United States and Canada participate in Amateur Radio Field Day. And this is an event that has started actually in 1933, when the amateur radio frequencies were under attack. Commercial operations wanted them. And the response of the Amateur Radio Relay League was, let's prove that we can operate in an emergency. And so, remembering the technology in 1933 of tube equipment, very large, using a lot of electricity, they said in an emergency, when electricity goes down, amateur radio operators can operate without regular house current, without the big antennas. They can operate from anywhere, even an empty farmer's field. And so they started Amateur Radio Field Day. And every year since then, on the last weekend of June, with the exception of when operations were shut down during World War II, operators from all over the United States have gone out to rural areas and set up and operated. I know Pacific County this year is going to be operating from Nakata. The Sunset Empire Amateur Radio Club and the Seaside Tsunami Amateur Radio Society have chosen to man the County Emergency Operations Center and be an endpoint contact to show that we could operate in an emergency. As I mentioned, this particular field day event started in 1933. The Astoria Amateur Radio Club started in 1931, so we were in existence 2 years before Field Day. And in a recent international publication called QST, the Amateur Radio Relay League publication, that talked about the history of Field Day, it specifically identified the fact that Astoria, Oregon station W7BB at that time, as opposed to our current club call sign of W7BU, was one of the main stations that was involved in that Field Day operation, and it calls us out in that article.
Hmm. Well, I have a press release here from the Pacific County folks, just to give you an idea. If you find this interesting, sure, and you want to just stop by, June 25th and 26th, as Don said, beginning at 11 a.m. on Saturday, running through 11 a.m. on Sunday, Pacific County Amateur Radio Club is going to be at the Port of Peninsula in Nakata. And you can just stop by. You just stop by for a few minutes, say hi. You'll find a bunch of really charming kind of radio geeks who want to tell you all about this. And it's a really interesting thing to get involved in. And even if you're not particularly wanting to become a radio aficionado, the power to go on a radio and speak legally during an emergency is a big thing. And that is part of what being involved in the ham radio community will give you. And that around here, since we're so prone to bad storms, you know, God knows, tsunamis, earthquakes, all those things, you have it within your power as an individual to get this license and to be part of what will probably be the only way to communicate when the big one really hits. The ham radio operators, all these hobbyists in their homes. I mean, because I've been, part of these events, and people have invested tremendous amounts of money in equipment and antennas and all this. That stuff is going to be operating because they have a personal investment in it as part of individuals doing this in our community. And so it's a very powerful thing, very interesting thing. And this Field Day is sort of a window into that if you wanted to just stop by. So where is the one happening here?
Locally in Clatsop County, we've got a couple of different places. One is the major clubs are going to be at the Clatsop County Emergency Operations Center at Camp Rylea.
That's at Camp Rylea.
And
okay,
we'll be operating from noon on Saturday to noon on Sunday. There'll be another club which is operating up at Bradley Park, up on Highway 30, up on the crest. And they will also trying to operate. And I believe as part of their operation, they are going to try to contact the ham radio operators that are on board the International Space Station.
Oh, yeah, that's always
so
fun.
When people ask me, how far can I talk on my ham radio,
really,
I say
really
literally anywhere in the world and outside of it. I myself have contacted astronauts on board the International Space Station.
I have too.
And I know Terry has.
Wow.
And we have proof of this. We receive certificates when we make contacts with these various stations.
Mm.
If you're new to the area and you'd like to see a ham station, visit the Columbia River Maritime Museum. And on the lightship, if you go downstairs, down below decks, to the radio room, that is one of our club's ham stations.
Mm, that's great.
Okay, and if you are interested, if we have piqued your interest to become a ham, consider it a family hobby. Mm-hmm. There are all sorts of families, a mom and dad, and the kids all get involved, and the kids are running around with little teeny walkie-talkies, and it's a great family sport.
Yeah, and as Joanne mentioned, and all of us did, in emergencies, it's a way of not only contacting the Emergency Operations Center. My wife is a ham, November 7, Whiskey Romeo Alpha. And during the 2007 storm, when we couldn't talk to each other on phones, we were able to talk to each other twice a day by ham radio, and I knew that she was all right, she knew I was okay, and I continued my operation at the Air National Guard facility and at the Emergency Operations Center. My son-in-law is KE7CVR, his wife KE7CVX, and now their two-year-old daughter, they've had to lock up the microphone on the radio because she's already started playing with it. But there are plans for her as soon as she can read in order to get her ham license.
I was going to say, if she passed the test, then I know that anybody can pass the test.
Well, as Terry said, the youngest ham in the U.S. was 5 years old.
Oh,
they
wow.
actually had to
That's
read
amazing.
The test to her and have her answer the questions verbally.
That's great.
But she was able to do that.
That's really cool. Well, good for her.
Well,
if there anything else that you wanted to cover, how much time do I have left?
Well, we've got a few minutes, and I was announcing and getting ready to talk, be engineering for this show, and I was really surprised to hear how many really family-involved activities are going to be happening this weekend in Seaside. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of fun things that are being planned that are not just wires.
Yeah. With CPAC, the Seaside Pacific Amateur Radio Conference, in addition to the seminars on communications, there is what's called Ham Basic 101, which is for those people who are new to the hobby, teaching them literally how to use their radio, how to turn it on, how to change the batteries, how to change frequencies. There are also non-amateur radio related seminars on various subjects, and because I'm a ham radio operator, I haven't even looked to see what they've got available. They also have what they call Radio Widow's Room, which is where those, in the past, the ladies who were not ham radio operators who were married to a ham could get together and they could discuss how they fit into this hobby and how they can support it. All of this down at the Seaside Convention Center and in the surrounding areas. There's, I think it's the Holiday Inn, the church across the street are all actively involved in it. And we're going to be doing demonstrations, which will include what's called Earth Moon Earth, where one of the stations is going to go outside and using a portable radio and a portable antenna, bounce a radio signal off of the moon and have it come to Earth, wherever it comes to Earth at that distant end. And there will be stations attempting to contact CPAC from other areas bouncing off the moon.
So when it bounces off the moon, do they know directly where that signal is to come, or is it just whoever catches it?
There's an approximate area. So for Astoria, it will be somewhere Florida, Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina. And there will be stations on the air who are trying to make contact with anybody in the Pacific Northwest as far as British Columbia, down to the northern end of California and Idaho and western Montana. That's the kind of coverage pattern that we have with it.
Interestingly, I looked up my first logbook when I became a ham in 1970, and my first contacts were on 6 meters, which is 50 megacycles, and my signals were bouncing off meteorite showers.
Correct. Yeah, meteorite bounce is one of the amateur aspects. There are 14 amateur radio satellites in orbit that are devoted to amateur radio that ham operators can use at any time. And, of course, as I mentioned, the ham radio station on board the International Space Station. Several of the astronauts and cosmonauts, and the previous, I think, Israeli and German astronaut, were ham radio operators, and so they could use these radios during their off times to talk to people on the ground who were literally not rocket scientists.
So you don't have to be a rocket scientist.
Not Are we all. Done,
not
young lady?
All.
I've got one other thing to say.